These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. These lectures are titled Introduction to Judaism, Part 2. Lecture 13, Minor Holidays, Then and Now.
We're going to conclude our unit on the Jewish calendar by looking at historically minor holidays. And with apologies to Cole Porter, how strange the change to major from minor. In most cases, the holidays that had been relatively insignificant compared to the other holidays that we've discussed so far gained tremendously in their importance and in terms of the number of Jews celebrating those holidays in the modern period. We'll talk a little bit about the historic background of those holidays and suggest reasons why they might be more popular today than they had been in the past. So let us begin with Hanukkah. Hanukkah is one of the best known Jewish holidays. The word itself, Hanukkah, means dedication, and we'll explain why it has that name. Hanukkah is unique amongst the Jewish holidays because it's mentioned in neither the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, nor in the Mishnah. And yet, it's this huge Jewish holiday. So what about the day prevented it from being mentioned in the Bible? Right? History prevented it, because the events that it chronicles happened after the events that are described in the biblical corpus of books stopped once the Jews came back to the land of Israel after the destruction of the first temple around the beginning of the sixth or the end of the sixth century BCE. You have the historical narrative of the Bible stopping, of the Hebrew Bible stopping. But the events that we celebrate in the holiday of Hanukkah describe what happened in that Maccabean revolt against the Seleucid Greeks from 168 BCE to 165 BCE. So chronologically, the holiday of Hanukkah is out of bounds of the Hebrew Bible. So that explains why it's not in the Hebrew Bible. But why isn't it in the Mishnah? Why isn't the holiday of Hanukkah mentioned anywhere in the Mishnah? Certainly by the beginning of the 3rd century CE, hundreds of years after the events that the holiday of Hanukkah describe, right, those events must have been well known, and the holiday must have been celebrated by large numbers of people, both in the land of Israel and outside the land of Israel. So why wasn't it mentioned? That's the question. We'll answer that shortly. A little more about the holiday of Hanukkah. We've got the internal rebellion by the Hasmoneans or the Maccabees. The name Maccabee means hammer, but it also could be an acronym for a verse in Exodus, the first letters of which are MCBY, Mi Kamocha Ba'elim Adonai, which in the proper historical translation would translate into who is like you amongst the gods from this period in Israelite theological development where there was still a recognition that other nations had other gods. Sometimes that verse is translated as who is like you amongst the mighty. But who is like you amongst the gods? Mi kamocha be'elim Adonai, yud hey vav hey, that YHWH transliteration. And that was the moniker of the Hasmonean family. So they're either called the Hasmoneans or the Maccabees. They, as we've mentioned before, were rebelling both against the Seleucid Greeks and the religious oppression that they were facing from Antiochus, the Syrian ruler, as well as the more secularizing Hellenistic Jews who were very willing to take on those cosmopolitan secular ways of the Greeks and abandon the traditions of their fathers. So the Maccabean revolt was both against the external enemy, the Seleucid Greeks, and the internal foes or enemies, the secularizing or Hellenistic Jews. The family came from Modi'in, and they eventually claimed, once they were successful, it wasn't all to their credit that they were successful in pushing the Seleucid Greeks out. The Seleucid Greeks had other bigger fish to fry in their international empire-building strategy, and so they thought it best to let the let the Hasmoneans win this one. So when the Hasmoneans did win, they took control of both the secular aspects of the government and the high priesthood. Well, that was a problem. Although the Hasmoneans were a priestly family, they weren't of the high priestly lineage, which are descendants from Aaron's grandson, Phinehas. So they were priests, but not high priests, yet they arrogated to themselves the office of the high priesthood. Similarly, they arrogated to themselves the political leadership of the country, but that, according to the Bible, was supposed to be invested in descendants of David. They weren't descendants of David. So on both counts, both in terms of temporal power and in terms of sacral power, they arrogated to themselves positions that they weren't biblically entitled to. Moreover, they became very corrupt. And by 63 BCE, one brother, because of infighting with another brother, invited Pompey and the Romans to come into the land of Israel. So the rabbis weren't interested in promoting this family because of their corruption, because they invited the Romans into the land of Israel, and because they basically ignored the separation of powers that is outlined in the book of Deuteronomy between the governmental affairs of the nation and the temple or sacred affairs of the nation. The Gemara, right, which is the second part of the Talmud, remember the Mishnah plus the Gemara equals the Talmud, in a section that was probably written about 500 years after the Maccabean revolt, introduces the story about the cruise of oil lasting for 8 days. That was the version that I learned in Hebrew school, and it's the version that is widely popular. So a little bit like Virginia, I'm afraid to tell you, ain't no Santa Claus, we have a similar story about this cruise of oil that lasted for 8 days. We know most about what we know from about the War of the Maccabees from the two books of the Maccabees, Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2. But they're not in the Hebrew Bible. They're included in a set of books called the Apocrypha, including the Wisdom of Solomon and Judith. That this set of books, the Apocrypha, was included in the Catholic or in the Christian Bible as part of their Old Testament, but the Jews didn't include it in the Tanakh. So if you remember in our very first lecture, we made the distinction between the Hebrew Bible and the Old Testament, or the Tanakh and the Old Testament. Well, the two names don't even include the same books. They also don't include the overlapping books in the same order. All the more reason to make the distinction between the Christian Old Testament and the Tanakh. In the Christian Old Testament, there are books that aren't included in the Jewish Tanakh. In those early eyewitness accounts or records of the Hasmonean revolt, we don't have anything about the cruse of oil being found in the temple and lasting for 8 days, even when there was just enough oil to last for a single day. The first time we see that story is 500 years later in that little piece of Gemara. In the whole big wide Talmud, Hanukkah is only mentioned 2 times, right? Both in Masechet Shabbat, in the Tractate of Shabbat, where it's talking about issues of lighting. As you light candles on Shabbat, you also light candles for Hanukkah. And we'll talk about the Hanukkiah in just a moment. The idea, the literary idea of the cruse of oil lasting for 8 days, where when there had originally been only enough oil for 1 day, goes back to try to explain the idea that this was an 8-day holiday. Well, the book of the Maccabees tells you why it's an 8-day holiday. Because when the Maccabees, in their attempts at being good guerrilla fighters, were in the hills attacking the Seleucids, they were getting very excited in the summer months, thinking that they would be able to rout the Syrians and to rededicate the temple that had been defiled by the Syrian Greeks by the holiday of Sukkot, that big pilgrimage festival that 7 days plus Shmini Atzeret at the very end of that 7-day period gives you the 8th day. So they were looking forward to this 8-day holiday of Sukkot. But they didn't do it in time, right? Wars sometimes don't go exactly as the commanders plan, and sometimes they trail on to unfortunate political consequences longer than the leaders had anticipated. But they did finally rout the Syrian Greeks in December, or in the Hebrew month of Kislev. And in order to compensate them for their depression and their disappointment at not being able to celebrate Sukkot at its proper time, they had an 8-day rededication ceremony to parallel the 8 days of Sukkot and Shemini Atzeret. That's the historical explanation why we have an 8-day holiday for Hanukkah. But the Gemara comes in and talks about this little bit of oil lasting 8 days. Now, this motif of a little bit lasting for a long time or going a long way is a common biblical motif. We see it with oil. We see it with bread in the Hebrew Bible, in the Tanakh, in 2 Kings chapter 4. It has another iteration in the New Testament with the bread and fish that Jesus multiplies. So this idea of precious resources multiplying is a literary motif that the rabbis took from the Hebrew Bible and applied to this oil lasting for a long time. But on a symbolic level, it's getting at a very important truth. One of my teachers from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, Baruch Feldstern, used to say that just because it's fiction doesn't mean it's false. And I found that to be very powerful. There is truth in the symbolism of this story that's found in the Talmud about this little cruse of oil lasting for 8 days. And that is that from the Jewish perspective, the purity of living a lifestyle dedicated to God and God's will in the midst of this vast Greek empire that included, from the Jewish point of view, Hellenistic practices involving sexual orgies, cultic prostitution, as well as their religious practices of idolatry, that represents the great environment of impurity, but the Hasmoneans were able to maintain that pure lifestyle. So just like in the midst of the ruins of the temple that had been defiled by the Assyrian Greeks, there was one little pach shemen, one little cruse of oil that was able to sustain that surviving remnant until more oil could be pressed. Okay. The next holiday that I want to talk about is the holiday. I'm sorry, I want to also talk about the reason why the popularity of this holiday persists even until today. The 8th day of Hanukkah, when there are a total of 8 candles in the Hanukkiah, plus the one in the middle that represents the servant that lights the other 8 candles, right? This is a Hanukkiah. A Hanukkiah has a total of 9 candles or 9 lights, 4 on each side and then 1 in the middle. For halachic reasons, you light the candles with the shamash or the shamash in Hebrew. Shamash is Yiddish. You use this central candle to light the other ones. The purpose of lighting the candles has an anthropological parallel in other cultures that have holidays of light in the darkest season of the year. And it always happens, because of the way the lunar calendar falls out, that the 8th day of Hanukkah, when you light the greatest number of lights, is the darkest day of the year. Why? Because it always falls on the new moon after the winter solstice. So anthropologically, we see that at the darkest time of the year, what do you want to do? You want to create light. Some people confuse the Jewish Hanukkiah, which has a total of 9 candles or 9 flames, with the menorah, which we find in the book of Exodus, which is a symbol of the temple. It's also a symbol of the Jewish people, but it only has 3 candlesticks on each side and 1 in the middle for a total of 7. In America, of course, the 25th of Kislev, which is the date that Hanukkah begins, and the 25th of December fall in the same season, sometimes even overlapping. And so the prominence of Hanukkah was raised by the centrality of Christmas in the Christian religion, and all of a sudden there became this tradition of giving lots of gifts on Hanukkah, one for each of the 8 nights in some families. This is a tradition. The tradition of gift-giving is not historical, it's something that really developed in America. Indeed, in other countries and in Israel, if you get anything, it's some nuts or it's some raisins or a candy bar, but the gift-giving quality of the day is muted. But Hanukkah is still very important in Israel. Why? Because Hanukkah celebrates the military victory of the ancient Israelites against their surrounding neighboring enemies. And that's exactly what contemporary Israelis need as a model for their own precarious military situation today. Okay. The next holiday is Purim. Purim literally means lots. We read about the holiday of Purim in the book of Esther, in the Tanakh, and the book describes how Haman's plot to kill all the Judeans, they're not quite yet Jews, was frustrated by Esther and Mordecai. This happens in that period after the destruction of the first temple, but before the Jews have been led back by Ezra and Nehemiah in the 5th century BCE. Now, Haman is a descendant of King Agag of Amalek. He's an Amalekite. And the Amalekites were very bad to the Israelites in the book of Exodus. On their way out of Egypt, the Amalekites attacked those that were straggling amongst the Israelites, the weak, the women, the children. And so the Amalekites have a very bad name in the Hebrew Bible, and there's a commandment to wipe them out. In the book of Esther, they are indeed finally all wiped out, as well as the anti-Judean riffraff that's trying to execute a pogrom against the Judeans all over the kingdom. No plunder is taken, and Mordecai becomes second in command in the kingdom of Persia. So it is a story of the reversal of fortune, where the Israelites escaped a near-death experience. The Israelites, the Judeans, experienced a near-death experience, but they came out on top. And that becomes really the paradigm for Jewish survival when they're stateless. They have nothing to rely on except the grace of God and their own cunning and their own wits in order to ensure their survival. Now, interestingly enough, the rabbis debated whether this text should be included in the Tanakh or not. Why did they have this debate? Because the name of God nowhere appears in the text. Right. That's unusual. There are only two other books in the Tanakh where the name of God doesn't appear, the Song of Songs and Ecclesiastes, right? The bulk of Ecclesiastes, anyway. The name of God is tacked on to the very end of the book of Ecclesiastes. Another reason why the rabbis debated whether Esther should be included in the Hebrew Bible is because the book is sexually suggestive, not exactly family reading. It is very burlesque. Now, ultimately, the rabbis decided to include this text in the Hebrew Bible precisely because it forces its readers to perceive God's presence even when God seems to be absent and the world seems to be full of chance. Remember, the name Purim means lots, right? Chance. Everything is up to chance, it's random, it's destiny. But the idea of Purim is that, no, we need to take control of our own destiny. We need to see God between the lines when God is no longer apparently or transparently acting in Jewish history. Now, the celebration of turning the tables on Haman and his sons and his henchmen becomes an annual event. And the timing of this holiday in the early spring parallels other carnival events that celebrate the near death of the winter months. So here we have another anthropological connection. But there's something that's characteristically Jewish about Purim as well. Here I'm reading from the 9th chapter of Esther. The same days on which the Jews enjoyed relief from their foes, and the same month which had been transformed for them from one of grief and mourning to one of festive joy, they were to observe them as days of feasting and merrymaking, and as an occasion for sending gifts to one another and presents to the poor. That's part of the mitzvah, part of the commandment of how we celebrate Purim. Why? So that it's not just another day to party. These things, sending gifts to one another and sending presents to the poor, have nothing to do with the story of Purim. They're tacked on as a kind of biblical, moral veneer to this otherwise rather bawdy holiday tale that is celebrated even today very energetically and enthusiastically. What do I mean by that? The Talmud says that we should overindulge. so that we can no longer distinguish between blessed Haman, between cursed Haman and blessed Mordechai. Now, that traditionally has been understood as a commandment to get so drunk you don't know good from bad. One contemporary Jewish renewal rabbi, Arthur Waskow, talks about getting so mellow that you can't distinguish between good and bad. The Talmud is not specific about the medium one uses to enter this state of a lack of differentiation between good and bad. But you get the sense that for some people, only when those distinctions become blurry or are erased does it facilitate their perception that God is acting in this world. Contemporary practice is a carnivalesque combination of Halloween costumes, gift-giving, tzedakah, giving to charity, drinking to excess. In Israel, plastic head boppers or hammers and silly string are part of the festivities. The next holiday, Tu B'Shvat. Why do I say holiday? Because I am a 21st century Jew. Tu B'Shvat initially wasn't even a holiday. It is not mentioned in the Bible. It's mentioned in the Mishnah as what? The beginning of the fiscal year for purposes of tithing agriculture. There was a tithe. You didn't pay with your money. You paid with your agriculture in an agrarian society. And you had to know when that fiscal year began. So it's Tu B'Shvat. Two is gematria, where every letter corresponds to a number. 9 and 6 are 2, so together they are 15. The 15th day of the month of Shvat is this is the beginning of the fiscal year for the purposes of tithing agriculture. No holiday, no celebration. We don't celebrate April 15th when we have to pay our taxes. Some people do because they no longer have to write out their forms and work on their forms. But there's nothing celebratory about this. Notice, we go forward 1,000 years. And in the Middle Ages, in the 16th century, Jewish mystics, and we'll talk about them in a couple of lectures, they imagined that God's blessings, God's beneficence, flowed down from the heaven like an upside-down tree, where the roots in God are in heaven, and the sap comes down the trees and fructifies at the very end of that on earth. They actually developed a Seder very similar to a Passover Seder with different kinds of fruit to facilitate the drawing down of these divine blessings. So now this day, Tu B'Shvat, has moved from being a fiscal year to being a day that's a semi-holiday. In the early 20th century, the Zionists, who wanted to plant trees in the land of Israel in order to dry up the swamps in the north and in order to reforest large portions of the north that had been deforested over the centuries, they latched on to Tu B'Shvat as a holiday to promote the trees in Israel. So it became a Jewish Arbor Day, and the Jewish National Fund sent around these little blue tin cans or pushkas, and every day or every before Shabbat, you would put coins in the pushka, and eventually the money would be sent through the Jewish National Fund to Israel to plant trees in Israel. A couple of decades ago, the Jewish environmentalist movement emerged, parallel to the environmentalist movements that's going on, the general green movement all around the world. And they latched on to Tu B'Shvat, not exclusively to promote the idea of Jews and the connection with trees, but to promote traditional Jewish wisdom on the environment. So I love Tu B'Shvat because it shows you the development of a day that moved from a fiscal new year for purposes of tithing to this mystical idea of drawing down divine blessing to a Jewish Arbor Day to a Jewish environmentalist day. Tu B'Shvat. The next holiday is Tisha B'Av. Tisha is the ninth, right? It actually means nine, Tisha, the ninth of the month of Av. And this is the collective day of mourning for the Jewish people. It commemorates the destructions of the first temple in 586 BCE and the second temple by the Romans in the year 70 CE. The prohibitions of Yom Kippur are also in effect for Tisha B'Av. In the evening, the Book of Lamentations, which describes the destruction of the first temple, is chanted in a very dirge-like melody. In Israel, there are several prayer groups that meet at the Haas Promenade, which overlooks the Old City. And so as the sun sets and we move into Tisha B'Av, these congregants take candles and chant the Book of Lamentations overlooking the new rebuilt city of Jerusalem. It's a very powerful experience. From the beginning of Av, the month of Av, until the ninth, there's a period of semi-mourning, similar to the first 32 days of the Omer, that period between Passover and Lag BaOmer. Next holiday, which happens just 6 days after Tisha B'Av, is Tu B'Av. Tu B'Av is not well known at all in this country, unfortunately. It's a combination of Valentine's and Sadie Hawkins, where the Mishnah describes the young women of Jerusalem going out to the vineyards and joyously dancing with young men. Now, this might be a sanitized rabbinic version of what actually happened, but in any case, the Mishnah describes this day as one of incredible joy, although once the temple was destroyed, it wasn't widely celebrated. Today, there are some Jewish kepels that are giving it a resurgence, and they celebrate the day with picnics, complete with Israeli wine. And now you can pick from wine from the West Bank, or the Golan Heights, or Israel proper, depending on your politics. Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh is the last holiday I want to talk about. Literally, it means the head of the month. Like Rosh Hashanah is the head of the year, Rosh Chodesh is the head of the month. In the Bible, the celebration of the new moon involved animal sacrifices, a festive meal, and abstention from work parallel to the other holidays. So it was really a semi-holiday. Once the temple was destroyed in the year 70 CE, the holiday was reduced to the singing of a handful of psalms in the synagogue. And that's more or less what it remained until the modern period. But already in the rabbinic period, the holiday was associated with women. Why? Most likely because of the parallel between the lunar cycle and a woman's menstrual cycle. So today, as a result of the forces of feminism, there are Rosh Chodesh groups that have popped up in major cities all over the world where women get together, and I don't know exactly what they do because I can't go. It's restricted to women, but they celebrate the new moon. There is an additional custom for women not to engage in household chores on this day. Sometimes Rosh Chodesh, sometimes the new moon is celebrated for one day, sometimes it's celebrated for 2 days. My wife does no washing whenever it's Rosh Chodesh, so that is entirely my responsibility. There's also a blessing that happens not at the time of the new moon, but at the time of the greatest waxing of the moon. So it's customary on the Saturday night prior to the full moon, and the full moon always falls on the 15th. The 15th is two, so that's why we have Tu B'Av and Tu B'Shvat, and Purim happens on the 15th in most places. Right, the full moon is when the spirits are out, and so we need to bring godliness into the world in order to combat those evil spirits on an anthropological level, in any case. So after Saturday night's Havdalah service, which brings out the Sabbath Queen, which ushers out the Sabbath Queen, it's customary to go outside and to literally howl at the moon by blessing the waxing moon. So this blessing is called Kiddush Levana, and it's done in sight of the moon. All the prayers are included in the traditional prayer book, but it captures the idea that just as the moon waxes and wanes, so too does our relationship with God, as well as our fortunes, and that we should always be trying to move toward the waxing side, the side of increased joy, increased dedication, increased love, right? Like the moon gets bigger and bigger, even though we know that there are cycles in life which will overtake us at certain points in our life. And this idea of cycles of life is a good opportunity for me to try to wrap up this unit on the Jewish calendar. The Greeks had a view of history that was entirely cyclical. So if you remember the myth of Demeter and Persephone in order to explain the seasons, right? And when Demeter and Persephone were separated, that's when the flowers withered, and it explained the death, the mourning of the natural cycles. Well, what Judaism does is to bring a historical understanding to the natural cycle. So we still celebrate Rosh Hashanah every year. That's the cyclical part. But Rosh Hashanah represents creation. We've got Passover that represents liberation. We've got Sukkot that represents that journey in the wilderness toward the promised land, toward redemption. And we've got Shavuot that represents the revelation of God's will. Jews, when they are referring to events that happened in their own past, they don't talk about winter, spring, summer, or fall. They're not plugged into the seasons. They'll say, oh, and just before Hanukkah or just after Pesach. It's the holidays that orient a Jew in time. Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote in his book, The Sabbath, time is like a wasteland. It has grandeur, but no beauty. And what the Jewish calendar tries to do is to give beauty to time by having these outposts in what otherwise would be a wasteland of time in order to promote the idea that history is going somewhere. There is a movement, there is a direction to history, and ultimately, history is redemptive, unlike Greek thought. Okay. Now that we've taken a look at certain concepts of the rabbis in terms of their belief system, their practice, and their holidays, we want to move into the Middle Ages that we've touched on in other lectures up until now and look at the very different Judaisms that emerge in the Middle Ages.